What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. What's happening, family? You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, and this is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. This week's feature is dancer, choreographer, storyteller, artistic director of Dance Brigade, and executive director of Dance Mission Theater, Chrissy Kiefer. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. Well, Chrissy, I want to start with a little bit about you. Where'd you grow up? What's your family like?
Sure. I actually, my most formative years were in Columbia, South Carolina, in the 50s and early 60s, if you can imagine such a horrible place as it was. And then my family moved to Cincinnati, and I left for the University of Oregon when I was 18 or 19, and I have never looked back in terms of going back on the other side of the Mississippi. And I'm the oldest of five children, and I had the great good fortune of studying ballet when I was a child, which sort of set me on a trajectory to be a dancer.
Talk about discovering dance and what worlds it opened up for you.
Well, I was, and growing up in the 50s and 60s, you know, we didn't have any profound television and or media. We had books and encyclopedias, and then those of us who were fortunate enough to be able to go take a dance class. And so I was able to study dance at a very young age with the Calvert Brody School of Dance in Columbia, and then I continued on with that. My mother was a dancer from New York. She studied in New York City and in Westchester County area as a young person, and then she would teach dance classes in the living room when we lived in South Carolina. And so it was always encouraged for us to be artists. I don't know about being an artist. I don't know that we even kind of looked at it as an art form, but we were encouraged to be, to go to dance class and study dance and round out our personalities by being dancers, or maybe cheerleaders, but you know, in that physical realm.
I grew up as a dancer in Las Vegas, Nevada, and ballet, jazz, toe, all that stuff. So when I talk to dancers, women in particular, I talk about growing up in the dance world as a woman and impact on body image, impact on narrative about what we were supposed to be and look like as dancers. And I love to talk to dancers who have broken through that, but I always like to sort of tap back into that experience and then the breakthrough.
Sure. So I was in Cincinnati. It was when the Balanchine era really dominated the aesthetic of what a dancer was supposed to look like. And it was, you know, as we all know, very long legs and very thin. And so being very thin, or even being enormously weight conscious, I would say since 6 years old, you know, when I finally had my daughter, it was the first time I just ate what I wanted. That was at 37 years old. And all the time before that, I was constantly thinking about my weight. I also had a muscular body type. And so when I started dancing and started the Wallflower Order in 1975 with four other women out of Eugene, Oregon, we got in and we were very attached to the women's movement. We celebrated our physicality and our different body types as being part of the aesthetic of what Wallflower Order was all about. And Wallflower Order also incorporated the martial arts into the movement style, because martial arts were a very big part of the women's movement at that time. And we were in Eugene and we were part of Amazon Kung Fu. So we had this overlapping art form, which included Kung Fu, modern dance, stereotypes, reoriented ballet, and we sang and we did sign language. And so we kind of mushed it all together and created quite a successful trip around the United States and Europe. And we had quite a very big career during from 1975 to 1983. And then we transitioned that into the dance brigade when we moved out to Berkeley. And then we started doing really intense storytelling, and we created the revolutionary Nutcracker Sweetie, which many of your audience knows that work. And that was a piece, a twisting of the Nutcracker that we had both Mary Watkins. She did the score for that, rewrote the Tchaikovsky score, and Terry Sengraf, who was also a luminary of the area, and she did all the area work. So it was a big extravaganza that we did at the Scottish Rite Theatre over a 10-year period.
Why'd you call it the Wallflower Order?
Well, I was reading a book by Ishmael Reed in college at the time called Mumbo Jumbo. And there were two groups in that book called, one was Just Grew and the other was the Wallflower Order. And I'm like, I'm reading this great book. And there's two names of these two dance groups. And I knew that the Wallflower Order was actually kind of the problematic group in the book. But when I threw it out, everybody was like, yeah, that's the name. And so it was about being wallflowers and being forced on the sidelines, not having the right body type, and having that those group of girls, those group of women come to the center and claim their power. And we also like the order thing because it was kind of like an order of nuns of all women being together. So it was kind of like a, and it worked. It was a great name, and I hold Ishmael Reading great reverence for providing us with that that title to our group.
Right on.
Yeah.
Chrissy, how do you interrupt some of the harms that we were talking about for the young dancers that you work with now?
Yeah, so we don't have they have so many of their own dilemmas out of social media. I would say that you could do a million and one shows on the tyranny of thinness in American culture, and how it's affected women and the whole diet industry that's attached to that. We're all learning to undo even the images that we have in our head, and we don't have any sort of requirements around body type in order to be in either the dance brigade or in our daughter company, the girl brigade. I hear horror stories of girls who've had to weigh in classes, and the early time of school. We don't, that is so far off of our radar of anything that we would ever do. And we try and celebrate our differences. And, whether it's class or race or, body types or abilities. And yeah, it's a journey to get to that place where you p even pull those own negative ideas and stereotypes out of our own heads, So, the body thing has always been kind of hovering over the dance world. You have to, of course, give credit to the hip hop dance scene really moved the tyranny of thinness out of the to dominate the lexicon. Like the women who do hip hop have so many, such a variety of dance sizes and shapes that they're kind of on the forefront of changing what's acceptable or allowed. I'm sure there's still a lot of struggle going on all the time, but you can really see that it's really changed. If you watch the videos and you watch hip hop shows and stuff, you see a wide variety of body types.
It's changed, but it also sort of flipped. So I grew up, right, as a black woman trying to be skinny, 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 and all of the things that came with that. Isn't about me. And then I raised a daughter who danced, but she came up in the hip hop era of larger breasts, larger butt, thicker thighs. And then for her, it was the tyranny of thickness. And then it was, I just want to have a butt. I just want to have big thighs. I just want to, like, and I was,
No way. Right. Well, you can see having a big derriere has really become the new desire and the new norm because so many people now pay to have. I mean, because I had a very big fat ass too, and and now I'm like, why could God, if I was young now, man, I would be the it thing, and but that's you look in the mirror in a ballet class and you're doing like, well, how am I gonna deal with this? So yeah, I'm sorry, I'm sure. Well, I had a couple of girls in Girl Brigade tell me that they, if they had the money, they would get a Brazilian butt lift or whatever it was. I was just like, oh my God, hopefully you'll change your mind by the time you get the money.
Well, her version of, she did squats and stuff. Our version of I must, like she was doing, squats to make it do what it do. Chrissy Kiefer, talk about the power of the body in dance to tell story.
Well, I think that any good artist, whether it's dance or music or poetry or writing, actually has to find a hook into their audience. And I do think that there's a way that dance transcends the everyday experience, and it allows people to tap into their own possibilities physically, and really causes a kind of disruption as well as an identity that can happen at the same time, where if you watch a really if you watch people moving in unison, which was really kind of a mantle that Wallflower had. We our political statement when we weren't making political dances was we dance as one unit, and we were trying to show collectivity and cohesion and community, all of those things that make us one. And the next eras of modern dance had many things happening on stage at one time, performance art. It wasn't about like a linear storytelling. It was more like, if you it might be this and it might be this and it might be this and it might be this. Whereas we've always been in a style of trying to gather everybody together, and so that everybody at one time or another says, me too, I feel that. I relate. I'm part of this. What about you? What do you think about how dance transcends?
Every time I watch dance, I cry.
Oh,
E
yeah.
ev ev
Every
every
time.
time. I mean, I what was that? So you think you could dance? Like, I mean, from that to lot, watching dance live in the theater, there's something about watching humanity expressed through being so. We live in a world where we're so, right, we disassociate a lot just to survive,
Just to
right?
survive, yeah.
And when you're watching a dancer just in their body having this conversation with you, I think we rely really heavily on images and on spoken words, right? Just to storytell. And so I think dance has the power to have conversations in ways that we're not able to have anywhere else than if we're in the middle of a dance story. Back to you. Talk about the intersection. It was a two-part question, right? Because first, broadly, the intersection of social justice and art, but then the intersection of social justice and dance.
So you want me to talk about social justice and dance?
We'll start with it broadly, right? Social justice and art, they intersect in these ways. It matters because.
Well, I think that we analyze art a lot through art history. So when we think about the great things of art, people didn't think they were great when they happened. They thought about it after they happened. Oh, like Guernico really affected such and such as us, Frida Kahlo's husband, what was his name?
I don't remember.
He made great Diego Rivera, he made great murals. Nobody like people didn't see the context quite as much as when they look back. So people look back at Isadora Duncan. They look back at these things, how they disrupted the norm. I think that what Wallflower Order and Dance Brigade did was the social justice that was attached to the movement. If there was a movement at the time, those people who were in the movement saw themselves reflected in the art. And so, therefore, it had tremendous meaning for multiple of reasons. So like when you were just talking about crying, like the first time I cry, like I've seen a lot of dance. I saw a lot of dance as a kid. Like the first time I saw Alvin Ailey was the first time I ever cried at a dance concert. And you know, people often ask me what affected me growing up, like how I shaped my thing. And I often forget to tell it, but Alvin Ailey, just those moments that I saw revelations when I was 19, sitting in a balcony in New York City where no one was there but me, I think. I saw how I was hoping that I was going to be attached to community and also telling a story with tremendous community component and beauty. And that's what I wanted to be able to share with my audience if I was ever going to have one, because I hadn't found my way yet. So you just see what Alvin Ailey created out of, you know, and a lot of why it was so important at the time was coming out of the 60s and the Black Panthers and Black Power and all. Like he represented something so profound in such a brilliantly classically, you know, but also very available for his audience. That material was of anybody who saw that knew what they were, what they knew something about themselves and about the community and saw themselves reflected back.
Yeah, I had a thought while you were talking about energy practices, and you probably n noticed I am just venturing into some parts of the healing world, but like shifting energy, shifting emotional states. I've worked with several healers now that an actual practice is dance. I just completed a sound healers class, and they gave us these early energy exercises. It was like, notice how you feel now, then go dance for 5 minutes, and then notice the energetic shift. I was like, of course,
Amazing.
of course, of course. And when that happens for you as an individual, right? If you're in a space, that's going to happen for the whole audience. All right. Well, let's talk about some of your audiences. Let's talk about let's start with Dance Brigade. Talk about Dance Brigade.
So Dance Brigade was kind of founded out of a huge political rupture that happened to the Wallflower Order in the 70s, in 1984, when we moved to Berkeley. We were woefully unprepared politically to move to the Bay Area. We're coming out of Eugene, Oregon. We broke up, and Nina and I formed the Dance Brigade, a lot in the same vein of effort. Wallflower Order was a collective. So we were meeting and fighting all the time, as well as dancing and doing shows and touring. And, you know, when you're in a collective, you can argue about the color of a leotard for 4 hours. You know, you can pick things that ended up being of absolutely no consequence but can become enormous political and personal battles. So the problems of that were put to the side when Nina and I started running it. And we had been on the road so much that we wanted to stay home, which was our new home was Berkeley and Oakland. And we started doing large community events. We produced a festival called Furious Feet Festival, which showcased dancers who are working in with political themes. And then, as I said earlier, we started the Nutcracker Sweetie. We kept touring, but it didn't have the same kind of, you know, as the 80s wore on, the women's communities across the country became less and less. So we weren't able to tour quite as much. And also, you know, our reputation was a little, you know, it was kind of funky because our fight had been so public and was kind of, it was an unfortunate situation. And then I was living in San Francisco and I started, opened up a dance center at 24th and Mission called Dance Mission. One is a way to support my own work because there were so many income streams that I was able to rehearse there and perform there and get my work out without having to rely solely on grants. And I knew that because of the kind of work that I was doing, I was not, I was, my work was not going to be continue to be funded. So I knew it was kind of a survival thing that I started Dance Mission. But you know, it's turned into a phenomenal community center with the work of lots of different people. Stella does an enormous amount of work. Sarah Kroll, who ran Destiny, is now the artistic director of Dance Mission. So that's awesome. That's totally awesome.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, and so I have like four or five people on staff who actually worked as dancers in the early 90s, and they all transitioned into being other things. Karen Elliott is our financial director, and she went off and became a CPA, and so now she's doing the finances of Dance Mission. We have a healthy budget that we hope to be able to maintain as the economy wafts all over the place right now. We have a huge adult program, children's program, theater. People rehearse there, lots of different companies. We produce other artists, and I think we have a good reputation for being really fair, really fair, you know,
I just had like
and producing and having a good eye for good work, but we don't by any means curate just based on our aesthetic. We have lots of different kinds of group using the space. We have a reparations program where artists of African consent can get discounts on all parts of our program. And Sarah Kroll's running a liberation academy for African people of African descent to be learning how to choreograph and dance. All kinds of things are going on over there.
I just have to, because I know she'll listen to it. I got to shout out, the people that helped me raise my baby. And Sarah's one of those people. Like
Yeah.
I'm welling up now. My daughter was a Destiny girl, and that body image stuff we're talking about, like just being to be, just for her to be able to be with Sarah, and
Yeah,
Sarah could hear the
there's.
way she talks about her now and how she impacted her life. Like Sarah's just.
Yeah. I mean, I have girl brigaders that still like call me up and want me to get together for coffee and stuff like that. It's a very, you don't know. I mean, that's why when I go back to my first ballet school in Columbia, South Carolina, I adored my ballet teacher, like, you know, she's not alive anymore, but you create these bonds at very formative time. You know, and your daughter probably learns much more than she'll even know. You know, she'll, you know.
As she is, it's things unfold for her. All
Yeah.
right, Chrissy Kiefer, y'all have it's Dance Brigade's 50th anniversary celebration season. Hey, that in itself is a celebration. Any artistic institution left 50 years doing what you do.
Yes.
Congrats.
Thank you.
Talk about Match Girl.
Yeah, so Match Girl was a piece that we did when I was in Cincinnati for our holiday season, even though it's such a grim fairy tale. You know, the Match Girl has all these visions, is very poor, lives on the street, and has all these visions by striking matches. And at the end, her grandmother comes and carries her away. So my Match Girl is set in a very urban, contemporary situation. And I have 10 dancers. And the match, it's set in kind of, I did a lot of research around the juggernaut of, especially the San Francisco quote, doom loop, and the juggernaut of intense drug addiction and intense poverty. And I really saw it when I was down there during COVID, and also at the corner of 24th and Mission, like, you know, how these two, the thing of poverty and drugs, start impacting each other back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And one of the things that I read about was the how the crash of 2008 exacerbated homelessness incredibly inside the United States, and how people lost their jobs. And the next wave of poverty came after the 2008 crash, and it doesn't get anywhere near enough attention. As much as even the crash of 29, this really set us on a trajectory and really wiped out Black wealth in a really big way. So we kind of use that as the framework for the launching pad for our story around equity, around, you know, kind of the financial. And then it's just this kind of street journey. And we talk about how people get addicted to drugs when they're living on the streets, and trying to bring some humanity, you know, because a lot of times, even from like well-intentioned people, I think they should just all be rounded up and put behind fences. And, you know, trying to bring like real humanity to the situation. And there's some really good rap, there's some good hip hop, there's some beautiful modern dance, you know, with beautiful images behind it. We have a very funny scene of of the ballet where they're on bungee cords, so they're actually jumping up and down really, really, really high, and you know all the rich people are there applauding their efforts, and then they throw pennies out at the end, and Megan Lowe sings throughout the whole thing some very provocative contemporary. Somebody reviewed it and said it was like a jukebox ballet. All the performers are excellent, very different body types, lots of humor, fun, and also tragic at the same time. And our match girl gathers with her community and prevails. So she's not carried away to the heavens. She lives happily ever after.
Fabulous. And Match Girl runs where and when and where do people get
Yeah,
tickets?
so it starts this weekend on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So that would be January 30th, the 31st, and the 1st. Friday and Saturday at 7:30, and Sunday for all of those of us who are getting older at 2 p.m. If you want to come to that show, get tickets right now because it's almost sold out. There's lots of tickets available for Friday, and it's at Dance Mission Theater at 3316 24th Street. And you can go to dancemissiontheater.org to get all the information about the tickets.
Fabulous. You have been listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, and this week's Resistance in Residence feature is dancer, choreographer, storyteller, artistic director of Dance Brigade, and executive director of Dance Mission Theater, Chrissy Kiefer. Chrissy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. That was great. I loved it. Thank you.
Wonderful. I loved it too.
Okay. Bye bye. I
Bye.
hope to
Have a great
see
day.
you.
You're gonna. You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.